So we've done the first two liners. I'm sorry to be moving quite so fast. And I know that the first two lines are really substantially the same. So let's move on. Hasten on. This is, as I say, the sort of unpacking of the significance of Buddha, the unpacking of what it is that you're going for refuge to, what you're affirming of the Buddha in going for refuge to him. So he's Vijja Charana Sampanno. Sampanno is possessive. It implies that he is possessed of Vijja and Charana. He has these qualities. Vijja is the Pali version of the Sanskrit vidya, which it's knowledge, but especially knowledge in the sense of esoteric knowledge in the classic Buddhist sense. In modern Indian languages, vidya simply means knowledge. So a high school is a vidyalaya, a store of knowledge. It's important to know these connections with modern Indian languages because, like our own language, it meanings change. So vidya means the special sort of esoteric knowledge of not merely of the nature of things, but the ways of the Dhamma, the ways of practice, the ways of working in the world, if you see what I mean. So it's the Buddha's understanding of reality from the perspective of his enlightenment, with an understanding of how to apply the Dhamma. It's got that sort of connotation. Knowledge in the sense of not merely a kind of circumspexis of things, but a detailed understanding of how to practice, how to put things into effect, and so forth.
Did you use the word method?
No, it's more doctrine here, but it's doctrine of method, if you like. Charana is more method. Charana is etymologically connected with the English word career. And you get it in Bodhicharya Avatara, the Buddha Charita. It means that it's a sort of conduct in the world. So he's got the esoteric knowledge of the ways of the world, how the Dhamma works, and he's got the conduct. He's actually applied it. He applies it in his own experience. So he's not merely a clever fellow. He's also exemplifies what he teaches. It also implies that he understands both the theoretical and the practical applications of the Dhamma. He understands the Dhamma from the point of view of the doctrine, from the point of view of practice. He understands it, as it were, in relation to others, and he understands it or applies it in relation to himself. So he's equipped with, endowed with, understanding of the nature of things, a deep understanding of the nature of things and how it all works from the point of view of spiritual life and practice. And he's applied it, and he knows how to apply it for himself and for others. So that sort of unpacks a bit the Buddha, his wisdom consists in. Consists in Vijja Charana Sampanno. So he's wise in a theoretical and a practical sense, and he embodies both that theory and that practice. He lives it. He's Sugato. Su is a prefix that you find in words like Subhuti, which means well, happy, good, wonderful. Well, you just could understand what it means. It's a highly positive prefix. When you put su before something, it implies having good things, good qualities. But particularly, it's understood here to mean happy. Gato means going. So well going, happily going, happily proceeding. So he's the one who, or even it can mean gone to, the one who's gone to happiness, the one who's achieved happiness. It's quite important, isn't it? That again, he's not merely wise in the theoretical sense. He's applied that wisdom, which has given him happiness, contentment, completion. I drew that out a bit in talking of both Pasada and Bhagavan. This sense of the contentment, the ease, the fulfillment that you get from both faith in the Buddha and especially being the Buddha. It completes you, it fulfills you, so you're happy. You're not discontented, you're not searching for anything. You know that there's nothing to search for because everything is there. Whatever you need is already there. So you're full, you're whole, you're complete, you're fulfilled. He's lokavidu. Loka is world, of course. Padma loka, Tara loka, etc. World, realm, sphere. But here it means particularly the worlds in the sense of reality. Everything it is. You get the Tiloka. In India the movement used to be called Trilokya Bauda Mahasangha. Trilokya referred to the three worlds of Kamaloka, Rupaloka, Arupaloka. Traditionally, although Bhante said it also could be understood to mean first world, second world, third world. I don't know where the second world is anymore. But yes, world, it's world used in that sense. All the different possible worlds which people inhabit. We talk about the criminal world or whatever. He knows a lot. He knows it all. He understands the nature of reality fully and completely, whatever kind of world may manifest, he's understood it. Vidu is a word meaning knowledge, but it's connected etymologically with seeing. You can see the etymological connection with the Latin videre, as in video, which is an old kind of recording mechanism that some of you may not remember. Before we had DVDs, I still watch them because you can get them for 25p in charity shops. So lokavidu, he's the knower of the world in the sense of the one who sees the world, or rather the seer of the world, in the sense of the one who knows it. Sometimes the Buddha says, when Mara tries his tricks, Mara or Kashyapa, you are seen. In other words, I know you. I know what you're up to. So it's seen in that sense. You've seen through, seen to the bottom. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, he hasn't necessarily actually encountered every world. But every possible world there could be, he's seen. Because he's seen the fundamental nature of things. The conditioned nature of things, the way conditionality works, the cyclic, the spiral, he's seen it. Whatever circumstances arise, that fundamental insight will be applicable to. So in that sense, wherever the Buddha goes, whatever he encounters, he's seen it. It's interesting, this capacity of the Buddha is said to have arisen fourth week after his enlightenment. He sat in what's known as the Ratanagar. I don't know, anybody been to Bodh Gaya? If you look at the Bodhi tree, it's off to the left. And he's said to have sat in a house, in other words, an imaginary house, or imaginal house, made of jewels. And from there to have explored the world from top to bottom, to have become Lokavidu. He saw all possible worlds and understood them fully and completely, when the buses would turn up necessarily, although apparently he could do that if he wanted to. But after all, why fill your head with bus timetables? Some people do. But but he understood their fundamental character and nature. So if you like, the Buddha is unsurprisable. He's seen it. He's seen it all. He's seen it to the roots. He's seen it to the bottom, the conditioned nature of things. Then he's Anuttaro. Sometimes this is alighted with Purisadamma Sarati. Sometimes it's counted on its own. Anuttaro is made up of an, which is a negative prefix, and uttara, which, well, we have the English word utter, in a sense of supreme. So in modern Indian languages, it means topmost or supreme. So it's anuttara, without anything higher. So you can take it on its own as meaning he is the one to whom there is no equal, for whom there is no equal, for whom there's nothing superior. This again is something very, very important that you're affirming. Remember that about all these. You're affirming that when you go for refuge to the Buddha, you're affirming that he really did see all possible worlds. He saw this world with its computers, its technology and so forth. He saw it in the important sense. He saw what it was, even though he'd never experienced it. So you can't say of the Buddha, he did understand, you know, 5th century BC India, but he wouldn't understand today. No, he saw it. His fundamental insight saw our world as much as any other. So in the same way, you're affirming the Buddha's supremacy. He is the highest being. There is nothing higher than the Buddha. This is a vital affirmation for a Buddhist. We're not saying that there's a God who's beyond the Buddha, who the Buddha, you know, is the prophet of, or the son of, or whatever, the worshipper of. We're saying he himself attained the highest that it's possible to attain for a being. What he attained, well, that's something else, and in a sense is even beyond him, in a sense. But as a being, he was the highest being that there could be. If you want to go for refuge to the Buddha, you need to be confident of this, that you really have understood in what sense he's supreme, and that you are convinced of that, at least in an effective sense, even if you haven't, you know, fully seen it for yourself. Then he's the Purisa Dhamma Sarati. Dhamma Sarati. Purisa is, properly speaking, it's man as opposed to woman, but it comes to mean humanity. A good bit of early Indian sexism. And even today, the modern North Indian word for the men's toilets is Purush. It just means male, man. But here what it means is human beings. And Dhamma is a particle, a suffix, that means capable of and requiring training. capable of in need of training. Sometimes it's said that this means all humanity, but sometimes it's also said to imply not just those who are capable of it, but who are desirous of it. You, in a way, you're not capable of it if you're not willing for it, if you're not up for it. You know that from if you've done any teaching at all, if people aren't at all interested in being taught, you can't teach them. There has to be some willingness. So if you are ready to be tamed, if you're ready to be trained, the Buddha can train you. He can't train you otherwise, you could say. Or you could say that it means that all humanity is capable of being trained, and he is the one that can train them. You can understand it in those two different senses. So sarati is sometimes translated as charioteer, but it seems as if the root meaning is the one who controls animals. So tamer would be just the right word. A lion tamer, a horse tamer, whatever. So it's the one who knows how to work with animals and sort of take them in the direction that they can be taken in. Which is quite an interesting sort of idea, in a way. It implies a deep understanding of their nature. One of our mitras in India is a snake tamer. He brought along to a retreat, much to the horror of many of the retreatants, a collection of snakes, including a king cobra without the venom removed. And it was quite extraordinary seeing him, taming it. He understood the nature of the cobra. He could make the cobra do what he wanted it to do. I didn't quite like seeing it, I have to say. But he could, he'd sort of keep working with it so that it couldn't strike. He could even get it to strike and just step back enough. He could keep it distracted with my hand, stretch around behind, take it hold by the tail so that it was up like that. So the Buddha can do that with us. An interesting analogy, isn't it? Because a snake is dangerous. If you get it in the wrong way, it will bite you, as anybody who's taught a mitra class knows. As Bhante can attest to the whole order. It's a question of to be an effective teacher, you need to understand the natures of people, you need to understand how to work with them, you need to understand how to draw them on, draw them out, draw out the best in them, help them to understand themselves. So the Buddha is an extremely skilled tamer of human beings. Again, you're affirming this. This is quite important, isn't it? Because you can say he was very, very wise, he did understand everything, but he really doesn't understand people today. You know, we're different today. He didn't understand the West. It's not appropriate for the West. You know, this was Jung's understanding of Buddhism, wasn't it? It was the cold-hearted gods of the East. Didn't really apply here. We've got a different psyche. But no, the Buddha had understood the fundamental character of humanity, and his Dhamma, in its broad principles at least, and probably in quite a bit of its working out, applies as much here as anywhere. Will apply even on Alpha Centauri, those little seven-legged green creatures with senses we can't imagine. He'd be able to tame them too. The Dhamma would apply to them. But again, these are all important things to understand and recognise in affirming the Buddha. They're important for you to affirm about him, because if you don't affirm them, there will be some disturbance in your own confidence, and you will not be able to fully submit yourself to him as the tamer. So he won't be able to work with you, you could say. Then he's Sattva Deva Manusanam. This is very, very important. Sattva is teacher, straightforwardly, the one who teaches. Deva is Deva, gods. Manush is even in modern Indian languages, in Gypsy, the Gypsy sometimes call themselves Manush. You know that Django Reinhardt and so forth. He called it was La Musique Manouche. So it's the same word. In modern Hungarian, the word for a man is a human being is Manouche, which they've taken over from the Gypsies. You don't tell them that, but they have. So Deva Manusanam, of gods and men, of gods and humanity. He's the teacher of gods and humanity. So really what this is saying is that he's the teacher of all beings, of all conscious beings. Indeed, the Buddha had, according to the canon, had many, many disciples amongst non-material beings, discarnate beings, to use the technical term, beings existing on other planes. You know, there's the famous cases of Brahmins who get fed up with the Buddha and go to Indra, the king of the gods, and they complain to Indra that we're not getting, you know, our proper due anymore because everybody's becoming the disciple of the Buddha. And Indra says, "Oh, did you say Buddha? Buddha Saranam Gacchami." So I always think of that as a bit of a Buddhist joke in that context. There are a number of jokes of that kind where the gods, well, the famous ones, aren't there, where people come to ask something of the gods and they say, "You know, I don't really know, go and ask the Buddha." So the gods are shown, presumably for heuristic purposes, worshipping the Buddha. But there are some cases where you get some sense that this has got something behind it. The Buddha is in contact with other dimensions of reality and was able to communicate with beings on those other dimensions of reality. Why not? His consciousness was not narrowly confined to a literal materialist dimension. He was able to, well, if you like, have dream converse. He was able to interact with beings within the dream and visionary dimensions. And within those dimensions, he was able to communicate. Why not? So if, at the very least, I think one needs to sort of think of the Buddha as transcending the merely narrowly material human consciousness. Even if we can't understand, if we don't have any experience of that, we need to sort of say, well, beyond this, there are dimensions, there are imaginative dimensions, which are, you know, have their own ontology, which he could course in. Later tradition said that during the day he would be teaching in the human realm, and at night he'd be teaching in the god realm. And no doubt, one way in which one could read that is that he had a very strong Buddha dream life. Interesting, Bhante has been talking recently about dreams he's having, in which he's teaching people. He's teaching the Karmapa the other day. You know, if you're a Buddha, everywhere. If you like, you know, do you know what I mean? Your imaginative life is a Buddha life. You know, if you're an ordinary Dhammachari, sometimes you have a dream in which your mum is telling you off. not telling anything about anybody's particular dreams. But if you're a Buddha, you're always a Buddha. Wherever you are, in whatever visions you have, in whatever dreams you have, you're still a Buddha. And if there are these other imaginary or other visionary dimensions, you're a Buddha there too.
I mean, that kind of correlates to something you said years ago, but the ability to see reality in dream. If dreams was another way to perceive reality.
Yes, yeah.
In meditation, in our work, normal experience, and also in dream state.
Yes, yes. Well, in the Tibetan tradition, they talk about six bardos, don't they? There are three that are connected with death. There's the bardo of the moment of death, the bardo of the clear light, and the bardo of the intermediate state, all the visions that appear. Then there's the bardos in life, of the bardo of ordinary waking experience, the bardo of dreams, and the bardo of meditative vision. So really what that says is there are many, many different modes of experience, and each of them is to be taken fully seriously from a dhammic point of view. So their ultimate ontology from scientific point of view is in a certain sense less significant. What's significant is the application of the Dhamma within each of those dimensions. So when you're dreaming, take that dream life seriously. And if you take your dream life seriously, it will also be an arena for practicing the Dhamma. This is certainly my experience. Interesting, I find it very often I get teaching in dreams. And that sort of thing. Or I'm teaching myself in dreams. Or having very significant encounters with very wonderful beings. As well as a lot of less honourable stuff, which I won't get into. You can have a lot of fun, too. Anyway, the Buddha is always a Buddha, even if Subhuti isn't. So the Buddha, that's the way I read that. He's a teacher of God's, and then that means everywhere he is, he's fulfilling this function of communicating the Dhamma, of being... a being of Dhamma, a Dhamma being. He never loses that function, that sense of himself. It goes all the way through. And I think you can take this almost from a modern psychological point of view. If you can think of modern psychology and modern abnormal psychology as dealing with all the dimensions of possible dimensions of consciousness. Unconscious, superconsciousness, and so forth, as not being properly integrated, so they become manipulative and problematic, or abnormal, as we say. Well, for the Buddha, they're normal, they're ordinary. He's the Buddha all the time within them. He's never rocked. He's never at a loss, even when if something went badly wrong with the chemistry of his body. He'd still be the Buddha. I had a very strong experience of that with Bhante in this recent illness. I might have talked about this at the LBC, but he took that temazepam because he had a bad sleep. And temazepam, I saw from my own mother's case, my own mother was completely paralysed from a stroke down the right-hand side of her body, couldn't move. And she had a spell of bad sleeping. They gave her temazepam. And for 24 hours... something possessed her. She was walking. And a long conversation with her about my own future schooling, things like that. Anyway, what I'm getting at is it has a big psychotropic effect. Mm. And Bhante was taking that. He's a very sensitive system. And it just, instead of giving him sleep, it knocked his sleep out completely. And then the whole system becomes quite dependent on it, and the doctors didn't spot it for some reason. So he hadn't slept for weeks and weeks. And when you can't sleep, you know the Stasi say that you just didn't need to put thumb screws on people and put them on the rack and so forth. You just deprive them of sleep for 3 nights, they'll tell you anything. And Well, Bhante was subjected to that, but even though, he wasn't functioning very well in ordinary terms and, couldn't sort of order things properly and so on, he was never not Bhante. It's quite extraordinary. He was never never lost that extraordinary breadth and depth, what I call the sort of that sense of a huge sky that you encounter with Bhante. He just never lost that, even though, you know, the radio receiver had clearly had a lot of, got waterlogged, as it were, wasn't picking up the signal very well. The signal was still as beautiful and as strong and powerful as ever. A very strange experience. I found it quite weird. It just made me realise the extent to which we are physical. If you see what I mean, a lot of what we are is physical. But yes, the point I'm making is that the Buddha, a real Buddha, is never at a loss. That whatever the machinery is like, the signal is absolutely dead on enlightenment. It never varies, it never wavers. It goes all the way through. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I've got that across. Yes, so he's the teacher of gods and men. That means that whatever beings he encounters, he's able to encounter them as a Buddha and to communicate with them if they're capable of being communicated with, if they're able and willing to receive him. He's there. He's teaching in his dreams, he's teaching in his visions, he's teaching in his meditation. Whatever comes to him, he's able to teach, because he's Anuttara. He's supreme. That's interesting. Buddho Bhagavati. He really is. The Buddha, extraordinary radiant being. This is what you're affirming. Itipi so, he really is, such indeed he is, Bhagava, full of this wonderful radiance and power. Arahant, completely liberated, fully free. Sama Sambuddha, totally, fully, completely, absolutely understanding the real nature of things. Vijja Charana Sampanna, endowed with both the theory and practice of spiritual life, and endowed with understanding of that theory and practice, and endowed with embodiment of it. He embodies it himself. Anuttara, the supreme being, nothing beyond him. Purisadamma Sarati, the one who's able to teach, to tame even, to train those who are capable of being trained, those who are ready to be trained. Satta Deva Manusanam, the teacher of gods and men, of all possible beings, he's the teacher. Buddho Bhagavati, the Buddha, the awakened one, the enlightened one, the one endowed with these wonderful qualities, that's him. That's what you're saying. Ti is an affirmation of iti, if you sort of mean at the beginning. It's the bracket that completes it. So, if you can say that with complete conviction, what was it? Avecha pasadena, full and perfect faith, unwavering confidence, this wonderful, beautiful state of conviction, then you're a stream action. Well, we're only looking for an effective level of that. Well, we'd be very happy with more. So then, having sort of defined, if you like, fully defined what you're affirming in going for refuge to the Buddha, sort of an outbreak of going for refuge to him. There's a sort of a sort of ecstasy of going for refuge to the Buddha. Buddhang yava jivatang. Yava means so long as. Jivatam, jiva is life, the span of life. However long my life may be, saranam gacchami, Buddhang Saranangacchami. I go for refuge to the Buddha. Whatever the span of my life, I go for refuge to the Buddha. That's what you're saying. Throughout my life, I go for refuge to the Buddha. So yes, those that part you haven't got in your version. Instead of Buddhang Jiva Pariyantang Saranangacchami, it's Buddhang Yava, Y long A V A, Jivitam, J long I V I T A M. Well, you can see the same part there. Yecha Buddha Atita Cha, Yecha, those being, those Buddhas, Buddha is plural, those Buddhas of the past, Atita is of the past, that were, those Buddhas that were, literally, those Buddhas of the past. Yecha Buddha Anagata, Anagata, who have not come, those Buddhas yet to come, those Buddhas who will come. Pachupana Cheya Buddha, of the present, those Buddhas who are now. Ahang Vandami Sabbada, to all of them, Sabba. Ahang, I, Vandami, I bow down, I salute. Vandana is the same as namo, the same as anjali. It's this prostration. Yeah, prostration would be the best translation. I prostrate to all the Buddhas of the past, all the Buddhas of the future, all the Buddhas of the present. To all of them, I bow down. And of course, what you're here doing is you're affirming not merely the Buddha of our history and his unique historical role, but you're affirming Buddhahood as a universal and sempiternal phenomenon. Buddhahood arises again and again and again. It's always a possibility. It's not simply something unique to our time. You know, that in Christianity this was a great debate, wasn't it? And C.S. Lewis deals with this. What do you do about the fact that there are beings who have not heard the salvific message because they've had the misfortune to be born on Mars? So C.S. Lewis tried to square that imaginatively with Buddha, the Buddha, with Christ appearing in different ways in different planets. But in Buddhism, this has never been a problem. Because the Buddha, although he is a supreme being, he's not, as it were, in principle, the only one of his kind. He's one of a class of beings who have arisen in the past. Traditionally, it's said there have been varying numbers of Buddhas on this planet Earth, each of whom has taught, his message has endured for a certain length of time, his sasana, his dispensation has endured for a certain length of time, then it's faded away and had to be revived by another. Some traditions say 4, sometimes say 7, some say 21, etc. And the Mahayana, of course, multiplied all the Buddhas in all the directions of space. It's just saying this possibility of Buddhahood is everywhere possible. And you're not saying, I'm only going to go for refuge to my Buddha. You're saying, I'm going for refuge to the principle of Buddhahood, to Buddhahood wherever it arises, however it arises, in whomever it arises. As I say, a sort of panegyric of going for refuge, an ecstasy of going for refuge. And it goes on. Nati me saranang anyam. There can be no other refuge for me. This is very important. The concept of refuge in Buddhism is exclusive. You can't serve God and Mammon. No, that's wrong religion. You can't go for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha and to God. or whatever. You are, by going for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, you are eschewing other refuges. So you're affirming this. There isn't any other refuge for me. This is the true refuge. This is the true source of security from the bondage of life. Only this can save me. Anything else that I go for refuge to is itself subject to conditions and can be disrupted, can end. Only the Buddha can be my refuge. You're saying that. Buddho me saranam varam. Varam is vara, is excellent, best, most noble, supreme. So the Buddha is for me the supreme refuge. Same thing in a way. But yes, you're saying that this is the final refuge, the full refuge. What part is this? Etena satyavajena, by virtue of this truth, this satya, otu me jaya mangala, may victory and mangalam is something like luck or auspiciousness, good fortune. May good fortune abound. May there be good fortune everywhere. So you're saying, by the truth of this, may victory come, and may good fortune spread everywhere. This is a very interesting notion in early Buddhism, which I think comes from the Indian cultural background. The power of asseveration, the power of truth. It's interesting, I don't know whether you remember this with Vaclav Havel. He wrote an essay called The Power of Truth under the old communist regime in Czechoslovakia. And he pointed out that under the communist regime, everything was a lie. The victory of the party was a lie. The complete devotion of the people to the party was a lie. The supremacy of that system was a lie. Everything was the opposite of what was said. In this book on Stalin, it talks about what's called in-depth language. So Stalin would say to people, "I will pardon, whoever it was." All the names have gone from my head now, but anyway, they've gone. I will pardon that person, even though he's betrayed me. But everybody knew, the Cheka, the NKVD, the KGB, they knew what that meant was kill him. So everything meant the opposite of what it seemed to mean. So Vaclav Havel said, the power we have as citizens is the power of truth. If we stand up and assert the truth, this system can't go on. Of course, you have to risk your life to do that. But I think that's a sort of flavour of what the Buddhist tradition is saying, that the truth is a power. If you affirm the truth, wonderful things can happen. The truth can change things. The truth can set you free. If you stand by the truth, if you declare the truth, the world shakes, as it were. So if you declare the truth of the Buddha's supremacy, the Buddha's being the only refuge, it brings victory. Because real victory comes only through that truth. It brings auspiciousness, it brings good fortune, because good fortune comes from karma in the end. So if you affirm the power, the nature of the Buddha, it changes the way people think, the way they act. So you could say this is part of our function as Buddhists, is to perform this act of asseveration, this act of conviction. Of course, we need to do it reasonably and intelligently and sensitively and positively. But we need to stand up and proclaim the truth. And, well, we say, may truth prevail, may truth bring victory, may truth bring good fortune. But in a way, we're also saying that it will, it must. Maybe, you know, when we stand up, in Stalin's Russia, we'll be killed. But, you know, what you see, in, I mean, I find it very, very instructive reading this about Stalin. I'm not, as a horrible lesson, I assure you. But, you know, thousands of people were tried by Stalin's, you know, show trials. All of them said, we will submit ourselves to the party, apart from one man who said that this is nonsense, I've not done anything. It's the system that is wrong. Only one man had that courage. And that's how the system it endured. Everybody's frightened, and they kept on, you know, out of fear, understandable fear, affirming falsehood, even though they knew it wasn't true. So this is something I think very much to be held to our hearts, that part of our function is to affirm the truth in an ordinary sense, but also in this a very lofty sense of affirming that the real supreme refuge is the Buddha. And if we do that, well, we can certainly hope that something wonderful will happen. Victory over everything that afflicts and disturbs and destroys will be attained, and great good fortune will abound. May grace abound and victory, I think is one translation. Bhante's, yes, may grace abound and victory, which is a nice translation, a nice interpretive translation. But Mangala is a bit like Bhagavan. It's that sort of auspiciousness, good fortune, as a quality that comes about, but can only come about through karmic, on a karmic basis. So there you are. That's the Buddha Vandana. I hope you've got some flavour of what you're saying, the very powerful asseveration that you're making in saying it. The more you can sort of put yourself behind it, the more you can be convinced by what you're saying, the closer it will come to being true for you, and the more you will be transformed, and the more of an effect you'll have on others. So yes, I think of this as a sort of Buddha's declaration of faith. But it spells out in greater detail what Buddhang Saranang Gacchami is saying. It makes much clearer, much more full what that means. So just a few minutes, anything that anybody wants to question? I've talked at you for quite a long time because there's quite a lot of material, but if anybody's not completely passive and... yes, good.
I've recently watched a talk online from the Dalai Lama.
Ah.
And in there he seemed to be saying something slightly different about other religions and traditions.
Sure.
He was basically, it seemed to be implicating that if practiced sincerely and in the right way, etc., that they are just as valuable for the people practicing them as Buddhism is for us.
Mm.
And that all traditions... should be able to, in an ideal world, learn and take from each other and grow from that.
Mm.
And he was pointing out, for example, that most of the Buddhist traditions are monastic, and that they could learn from the Christians going out in the world and helping, you know, Christian aid and that sort of thing, and that he would like to see more Buddhists doing such things. And that seems to be contrary to a line that you've just said about other traditions
Well, I'm aware of the Dalai Lama saying things like that. I think if you read them very carefully, he's leaving himself wriggle room, because it's not what he really thinks. I'm convinced of that. I think that the Dalai Lama is in a very, very awkward position. He's both a politician, a leader of a people in exile, and at the same time a very strong religious figure, a widely respected religious figure. So I think that I would be extremely surprised, and I have seen things that the Dalai Lama has said in other contexts, which suggest that he is well aware that the Buddha would not agree with him.
But then that again contradicts the fact that he's a speaker of truth. He wouldn't say it just because he wants to be conformist. He would only say it if he believes it. I mean, it's the Dalai Lama.
Well, I suppose one has to question the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
I think that's my position. He's undoubtedly an extraordinary man. There's no doubt about it. But I have come to learn quite a bit about the whole Tibetan scene. And it's a very, very complex picture. So I think that you have to read whatever the Dalai Lama says when he's not teaching ex cathedra, in which case he'll say quite different things, I think. But his general statements, his general sort of message will be one that really is trying to promote harmony, peace, and so forth. Now, I would want to do that too. I wouldn't want people to start persecuting others because they had different beliefs. But I'd certainly say that there's quite a lot of good people in many other religions. My own brother is a Catholic priest and I believe he's a good man. But there are good elements, good teachings within many other traditions. But the fundamental Buddhist position, and this goes right back to the Buddha himself, is that there is something different. So we are saying that the Buddha is supreme.
Yes, but he specifically recited, for example, a Catholic priest who had spent 20 years in solitary in the mountains. And when the Catholic priest came down, he said to the Catholic priest, "So what was your practice?" And the Catholic priest looked at him with what he called a significant look and answered, "Pure love." And he immediately drew parallels between him and Milarepa. So he did seem to genuinely believe, and also my own intuition and belief goes that way, that the holistic approach of recognising that these things are valuable.
Yes. That I would agree with you. Some of these things are valuable.
Yeah,
I wouldn't disagree with you, but I think there is something that as a Buddhist one is affirming, which is not affirmed in these other religions. Yeah, and in that respect, I would suspect that the Dalai Lama is speaking with extreme caution. And I wouldn't necessarily agree with him that monk who'd come down from the monks from the mountains or whatever. One might agree that he was a very, very good man. One might even agree that he was enlightened. But in that case, he would have a great deal of difficulty. And you can see that with, for instance, St. John of the Cross, who has insights that seem very sort of familiar to one, but he was not able to teach openly, and he was confined to his cell. So that there is in Buddhism, you get a clearer and more unambiguous statement of the ultimate nature of things than you do get in other religions. That's what the Buddha taught us, and what I certainly believe, and most other Buddhists would believe, and I think what the Dalai Lama really believes. Even though that doesn't exclude one from honouring and respecting and
but
even
do you not see the
others.
Danger that if you think yours is that way rather than a way, and you decide that yours is superior to all others, then you've immediately separated self and other, and you've immediately gone against what I see as Buddhist principles by that very statement?
I think we'll just have to agree to disagree on this. I don't think there's a profitable argument there. But that is what Buddhism teaches, generally. And I think you'd find that if you look closely at what the Dalai Lama says, it's more nuanced. But it's certainly one does not want to have quarrels with other people of an angry and hostile nature. And sometimes they may be better people than you, ethically speaking. So that one shouldn't assume that because somebody is a follower of a different religion, that they're not as good a person as you. I certainly know people who are from different religions who in many respects are more ethical than me.
Can I just take it back to the text?
Sure.
I'm not completely clear over how much do you say is this referring to the historical Buddha? Or is the Buddhahood throughout that we're talking about as a concept? Or the man, the historical man, we
right.
refuge towards the humanities?
Yes, well, I think you'd say in the first place it's to the historical individual. But who is the historical individual, if you see what I mean? What exactly is he? And the historical individual touches on something that goes beyond history. So it's as if you're doing both. It's through the historical individual that we know of this state of enlightenment that occurs again and again and throughout reality. In the first place, we're going for refuge to him. But through him, we're going for refuge to all those who've attained that state.
Because before his parinirvana, as I understand it, he did make mistakes and people even killed themselves on his teachings, and etc. So we're then talking that he represents Buddhahood as well as this supreme, perfect knower of all. Well, does it come together?
Well, the point is there that he can make mistakes. Bhante said that he found that incident where the Buddha gave a meditation practice to people, which they misunderstood. It wasn't that the practice was imperfect, but they misunderstood, they misinterpreted the practice, and thought that it meant you should end your life because there was no point in living further. It wasn't they didn't commit suicide out of despair, but essentially they were Jains, if you see what I mean. They committed the act that Jains sometimes perform of self-suicide because they've gone beyond clinging. So yes, the Bhante said that the fact that the Buddha gave that teaching and people misinterpreted it gave him, Bhante, great comfort.
Does that mean that we're separating out and saying that for the sake of being able to completely surrender ourselves to the ultimate highest, we must be able to see it as supreme enlightenment and perfect in every way, but still hold the acknowledgement that even this supreme enlightened being can make mistakes?
Yes. Well, a distinction is made between the Buddha's is sometimes called omniscience. It's said that the Buddha is omniscient, but in what respect is he omniscient? He's omniscient as regards the path and the goal. But he's not omniscient about the coming and going of the number 8 bus. If you see what I mean, he does not have, sarva dharma nyata, the knowledge of all the modes. In other words, all the modes of spiritual progress, all the ultimate nature of things, but he doesn't simultaneously know all facts, if you see what I mean, and therefore cannot necessarily know everything about everybody. If he turns his mind to it, it's said that he can. So he can if he turns his mind to a particular topic. It's said that he has got a sort of perspective outside time which allows him to know. So presumably if he'd turned his attention to what would happen when people did that practice, he could have known. But you can't within time be constantly referring to a point of view outside time, if you see what I mean. You can't simultaneously know all facts within time and be in time. Do you remember that? There's a famous story by Borges called Funes the Memorious. It's about a man who's riding along and falls off his horse and bangs his head. And he's condemned never to forget everything. All his knowledge is simultaneously present to him of the past. And so, of course, he can't do anything. So he's cursed by remembering, you know, the veins on a leaf that on a tree as he drove by. He can see it all simultaneously. So in the same way, the Buddha, as it were, is capable of turning his attention to anything and seeing it fully and properly. But you can't function in time in that way. But what he does have is omniscience as regards the ultimate nature of things and the nature of the path that leads to it. Do you see what I mean? So you're not affirming that the Buddha is perfect in the sense of not being capable of missing the bus, if you see what I mean, and of even giving advice that people misinterpreted. Yeah, is that clear enough?
Yeah. You made a distinction between if we really said these words, if we really meant them, then when the 11th stream entry is, in a sense, what we're trying to do as our ordination is to do it effectively.
Yeah.
But I just wondered if you could say a bit more about what that would mean. I wondered if it linked to what you said in your paper about this, as if, you know, this kind of, this philosopher talks about as if you can have this kind of, you can think of the bodhisattvas as if they are real, almost like a sense of, maybe for me, that it almost like suspending disbelief, and then it has some effect, it has some sort of
content,
and perhaps is that what we're trying to sort of almost have, if there's something in here which will suspend belief, and then it has an effect, I wonder what would make that effect.
Well, I think here that one isn't merely affirming as if, because you are affirming to, of course, the means by which you know is another question, but you're affirming that you do strongly believe that something happened historically, and that Buddhahood was attained, and that you are, so to speak, the heir of that. Major questions of skepticism arise, you know what I mean? The means by which you know have to be tested because you weren't there, you haven't got a video of it, you haven't got a signed certificate, you're joking apart. Like any act that took place in history, you cannot be completely certain of it. You know, I'm pretty sure that Elizabeth I lived. I think the evidence is probably strong enough to say that she really did, and that, you know, the Armada was defeated, and she did say that if I had the heart and stomach of a man and all that, but I don't really know. So you'd have to say that at the level of reasoned proof, you can only go so far. I think there are extremely good reasons for historically believing that the Buddha did live. Stronger reasons, incidentally, than for believing that Christ did. Not that I'm saying to you. Do you see what I mean? There are historical... there's so much historical evidence, so close to the time of the Buddha, it's very difficult to affirm that he did not live. Then you have to see his teaching, you have to see the accounts of his life, and you have to sort of make up your own mind as best you can. Did he... attain what I think he attained, or what he claimed to have attained, and there you really pass beyond reason. You have to move into a realm which is a bit more not a leap of faith, that would be the wrong way of putting it, but a reasonable move into a kind of accepting it. It seems to me, and I feel very strongly convinced that this is the case. I can't entirely prove it. But, you know, I'm going to act on this basis. So maybe in that case, your as if is a useful contribution to the discussion, that you sort of come as close as you can to a historical proof. You come as close as you can to an examination of the evidence, from the examination of the evidence to a willingness to affirm. And then you go that little step further and say, well, something about this that I pick up on an imaginative level, if you like, pick up on the level of spiritual intuition that seems to me to go beyond that. Here, of course, you cannot expect other people to necessarily agree with you. Do you know what I mean? It's not something you can advance as an argument. You can't say, well, it seems to me. Somebody else will say, doesn't seem to me. But I think it is good enough. It's good enough for me to say that I'm convinced that the Buddha did attain what he said he attained. You know, and I have certain experiential proof. I've practiced what he taught, and I found it to be true. So your affirmation is based, in the first place, on a real understanding and a sort of a reasonable historical conviction, if that's important to you. And then it's based on the ring of truth, reading it and thinking, well, yes, this ring is true. And then it's progressively based upon the exemplification in the life of others and the increasing verification in your own experience. Why the stream entrant is really able to go for refuge is because he's fully affirmed it in his own experience. If you see what I mean, that's the difference. Because the stream entrant is not merely saying, this really is good enough for me and I'm going with it. He's saying, it's not just good enough for me, I know it's true because I've done it. So that's an interesting way. Thanks for the question, because it brings out something I hadn't really seen before, the difference between effective and real going for refuge. The effective going for refuge, you still have not got the clincher. You've got enough to keep you going, to get you going. But it's very much a sort of, in the end, an intuition. And that intuition, of course, can be mixed up. That's a lot of what we have to do, isn't it? Is sorting out our intuition about these affirmations from our, desire for security and etc. You have to sort all that out.
Do you think ideally you need to do a lot of kind of historical research and looking, learning the Pali words and really get as close to the Buddha, his historical Buddha, as you possibly can in that kind of...
I think everybody needs to have a strong sense of the historical Buddha today. I don't think it's always been necessary in the past. I'm quite happy to accept that in Tibet and China, the Buddha was not that important. The historical Buddha was not that important. But I think today it is, because of the caste of our culture and the caste of our minds. So I think everybody needs to have a strong sense of the historical Buddha and a strong sort of sense of his historical existence. But I don't think everybody has to become much of a scholar in it. And it depends a bit on your character. Some people are of a sceptical nature and will need to investigate and question and go into. It doesn't mean they're better. And some people will just sort of feel, good enough for me. But I think we all need a strong sense that the Buddha did live. I think otherwise it becomes very easy to slip into a merely palliative version of the Dhamma, do you know what I mean? You can comfort yourself with the thought of the Dhamma. But if you see that the Buddha really did do it, if you feel that he really did do it, and you gain a strong sense of him as a historical being with whom you are connected, it gives you a strong motivation to act practically yourself. And I think that's the big issue. And you see that in so much of Buddhism, that people have a lot of faith in the general sense, they do nothing about it, or very little about it. They just keep an ordinary life. And there are those who do a lot in all traditions. So I don't feel that you need to do a lot of historical research, unless you find in your mind a sort of question coming, which is a barrier for you. What, did he really exist? I don't know. How do I know? What did he really say? Well, if those sort of questions come to you, go and do research. It's not that hard to do. Vishvapani's book is very, very good in that respect. I do strongly recommend it. I don't know whether it's generally doing the rounds, but I think that he's approached it from very much an ordinary reader's point of view, so something of the Buddha's transcendental magic doesn't come through. But I think that he's brought together the facts of the Buddha's life. He's written a biography of the Buddha, and he's done it very well, I think. So if you do find yourself concerned with that, maybe everybody should read that. But don't forget there's a magic, a sparkle to the Buddha that Vishvapani, by the constraints of his task, was not able to bring through, I think. But I'm more and more convinced that having the Buddha more central to us and more at the heart of our sort of faith is central to us really making the Dhamma live in the modern world. Because the sense of history has become so strong. And he's the intersection of history with eternity for us.